What's happening, y'all? This is Todd Wilson with another episode of Elevate Your Game. Today we have Father, former Division I player, former pro. He's the current head coach of Rancho Verde High School, current director of West Coast Elite IE. Mr. Johnny Dukes, man, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Nah, man, I was he reached out to me on Instagram. We have so many different connections just through the basketball world, and I grew up watching him in the IE myself. So just a blessing to have him on the show, represent the IE. We still don't get enough love out here
still
in Southern
California.
Still don't
get enough love. We can talk about that.
But we here. So we love to start the show off with the Wall of Hoop movies. Your favorite hoop movie of all time and why?
I would have to go with Love and Basketball. That was kind of a staple growing up where I was coming from, and just the whole concept of obviously you want to get to the league, and then, you know, the whole girlfriend thing. Not many stories go that way, but that was one that we definitely watched growing up over and over.
Yeah. Would you be a stay-at-home dad like he was at the end of the movie watching your girl at a WNBA game now?
I mean, if I had kids, and if I'm taking care of the kids, I would consider it just so I can really be hands-on and involved. But I don't know. I'm not the guy that kind of could just be stationary. Like, I'm very busy, so I'm kind of always on the go, on the move. That could be a discussion, I guess. I would lean towards it, but yeah.
You saw all those memes come out when, you know, these girls were starting to get paid with NIL deals and all that, and dudes is like going after them. So I had to ask. He was on the sideline cheering, like, look at Bobby. Like, hey, I respect it.
I'm not sure I could do it, but, you know, in a relationship, you got to be open to things. So maybe. Okay.
All right. So when did you fall in love with basketball?
I picked up a basketball when I was around 5. I think when I hit middle school, maybe 7th grade, I think I developed a passion for it, and that was literally all that I wanted to do. At times where I didn't even really want to go to school, I just wanted to play basketball. So I think my passion developed maybe around 12.
About 12, okay. 12 years old. And then when you first picked it up, was it just from playing in local rec leagues? What was the inspiration for you to get into basketball?
I started out playing at recess at school, and then PE in middle school, and then just kind of told my mom, hey, I got some friends playing at the Y. Let's play at the Y downtown San Bernardino, and got to play at the Y and play on my first team, play with Kevin Houston, my cousin Deshaun, and we played for the Bulls, and this is when the time when Jordan was running the thing, so kind of developed it then and ran with it from there.
Man, dope. And then a lot of people don't know what it's like in San Bernardino, man. Explain life in San Bernardino, how it was for you growing up.
It ain't for the faint of heart. You gotta have some tough skin coming out of the Dino. It's not the most beautiful place in the world, not the safest place in the world, but it's home. Once you learn how to navigate through certain areas and move a certain way, you'll be all right. But it's a tough place. Not really on people's bucket lists or destinations to visit.
No, for sure. We used to play, there was another Tar Heels team actually out there that we used to play all the time. And so we were in San Bernardino a lot just around that age. And you can just feel the difference in the environment because it's all hot in the IE. Just the heat is just crazy. And then in San Bernardino, there was a chip on these kids' shoulders, man. That was different, the toughness that we didn't experience coming from Corona, where we was in, you know, it was the beginning of like suburbia in the IE for us. And so definitely have respect and always when we stepped on the court with people from the
San Bernardino babies get it out the mud. Like that's the definition of that. Because you cannot be a weak person or a weak-minded person because you'll basically get punked.
Yeah.
And if you don't learn how to defend yourself, you could be in trouble. Because once we sense that, it's like a shark in the water with blood in the water. So they will eat you alive.
And then you start taking it serious around that middle school age, 12, 13. What changed?
I just really enjoyed it. And, you know, I got to watching the NBA and seeing some of these guys, and obviously as a kid you had that dream of one day like being like Mike or Shaq and Kobe, and it just kind of developed into a passion. And like I said, it was literally all I wanted to do. I would come home from school, go right outside and play till the street lights came on, and went back in the house. And I would be jumping the fence at the elementary school where I wasn't really supposed to be going to play because they had the full court with some of my friends. And I just, it kind of came natural to me. And I was obviously a tall kid, so I would, you know, be the biggest kid out there. The one thing though that I hated, because I was tall, everybody wanted me in the post. And I always thought I could dribble. So I wanted to play on the wing and everybody was trying to stick me in the post. And these were like friends and other players, some coaches too, but I wanted to kind of play out on the wing.
Yeah. And did you start playing AAU around that time as well?
I actually did not play AAU to the end of my sophomore year.
Really?
Yeah. Man. I was a late bloomer when it came to AAU. Again, we played at the Y. And then it kind of transitioned to the boys club. Then they created that Junior Lakers League where everybody started playing in. But that wasn't really AAU. That was kind of was the rec. And then if you did well, you would go play almost, not a national thing, but you would go out to LA and all these other cities and play the better teams. But after my sophomore year, we ended up losing our playoff game. Keith and Julius approached me and Sean Marshall. Mm-hmm. And Sean was a freshman, so that's when he started playing AAU. But they approached us and we went to a tryout, obviously made the team, and that's how we started playing for IBP. But like a lot of, you know, these kids nowadays are playing travel ball from
4 years old.
4 or 5 years old.
Yeah.
I was 15 years old.
Right.
So,
yeah. And then so you mentioned you and Sean. Did you know him before high school?
Yeah, because his older brother, I'm between him and his older brother, so. My freshman year, Sean was in middle school, and his brother Tyrone was a sophomore. So I knew Tyrone from high school, but me and Sean kind of met at the Johnson Center playing there. And then when he became a freshman, my sophomore year, we were the two youngest kids on varsity. So me and him, we created a quick bond because we got bullied and picked on and beat up by the older guys. So we were the two youngest, so we kind of stuck together, and we've been best friends ever since.
That's dope. That's dope. And so how did the tide change going from, you know, playing Junior Lakers and those events and then going to high school? What was the biggest difference that you saw?
So playing varsity fairly early, sophomore is not, I mean, some freshmen do play, but the guys were just bigger, stronger, and faster. Like the game had a different speed to it. And I was like 6'6", so I was as tall, I was actually the tallest player on our team, but I was probably the weakest player on the team. Mm-hmm. So I got pushed around a lot. So my sophomore year, I spent a lot of time figuring out the physicality of the game and the speed of the game and athleticism of the game. But it helped mold me because my junior and senior year is kind of where I started to have some breakout and experience some success. Luckily, our high school team was always really good. So every day going against older guys and bigger guys kind of helped me out with that. And then, you know, it translated and I was able to have a successful high school career.
Awesome. And it was Ike your home school?
It was my home school.
Okay. Yeah.
I lived right up the street, walked to school.
Yeah.
Until I started driving, but yeah, I walked to school every single day. It was less than a mile, I would say.
Yeah. So. It's so interesting now because, you know, kids come from everywhere to go to every school and to transfer or whatever it is. It'd be interesting to see if everybody went to their home school now.
What it would look like?
Who would be winning, right? Who would have all the talent? And, you know, I think we could even separate IE, OC, LA, and Valley or whatever. And I'll be so interested to see because y'all were stacked. And your neighborhood was that good.
Yeah, we had some dudes.
Yeah.
Played with Alex Acker, who went to the league. Obviously, me and Sean. Corey was a transfer, but we had a lot of local guys. We didn't have all these kids flying in or coming in from all these other areas that didn't live in the area. We had some talent. Before my freshman year, we had this kid named Trunell Eddings. I don't know if you remember Trunell. He was a little bit older than you. Mm-hmm. So, but he was like a 5'9 guard. But I remember just going to the varsity games and how packed it was and watching him pull up from the white volleyball line. But ironically enough, he ended up at UCR, finished his career at Cal State San Bernardino. But they said if he was 6'2", he probably would have went to Duke. So wow. he was special. He was just small.
Yeah, that was before my time. Yeah, I started really watching. I started paying attention to other people playing basketball right around my freshman year, sophomore year. So right when I saw you guys.
On my way out.
Yeah, yeah. And I just remember it was one game. Y'all had to have like 5 or 6 back-to-back-to-back dunks. It was the IABP Spring League, man. It was – and it became – I'm light skinned, so Sean was like my favorite player. Yeah, like, you know, just like, man, there's light skinned people doing that. I gotta do what he's doing. And the nastiness, though, in which y'all played, but it kept it in the game, man. It was like, that's where I don't know. I was like, okay, I know where I need to go. And so it's always cool to see that. So throughout that journey, all the way into IABP, there's always a coach or someone kind of pulling you along and keeping you focused. Did you have someone like that?
My high school coach, he was crazy. like we called him the high school Bobby Knight, because he would go off on us. But he all of the things that I teach nowadays, especially defensively, because I'm known as a defensive coach, I learned from my high school coach 20 years ago. And I had the same concept, shell defense, help side, help to help, all that stuff. I still implement it today. So he was the one. I wouldn't say he inspired me to be a coach, because I never thought I would be a coach, but I definitely took heed to the things that he was saying. And he got on me a lot, but the one thing I learned quickly when your coach is getting on you is because he cares. Yeah. And he sees something in you. When he's not on you, that's when you should worry. None of these high school kids are doing everything correctly.
Right.
So you should be getting on your players about certain things, but there are some that have a potential to be special, and you got to really push those kids to be special.
Were you able to recognize it then, that it was because he cared, or is that something you
at first kinda... I was just like, man, why is he always on me? Like, bro, chill, man. But it was all I knew once I hit high school, so it was just kind of second nature. It didn't bother me. Some kids can play, get screamed at, some kids don't. That's one thing I figured out, like, when I got into coaching, you got to handle certain people a certain way. You can't yell and scream and be in everybody's face. Some will respond to that and some won't respond to that. So
right.
Just got to be able to find that happy medium.
Different generation, for
definitely
sure.
Definitely a different generation.
But it's interesting, because if you go to a college practice,
they don't care.
They don't. No. And so you do have to build the thick skin somehow, some way to be able to, you know, eat the fish, spit out the bone if somebody's yelling at you and motivating you in that way and cussing you out and crazy stuff. And so
you definitely have to figure that out, because for the college coaches, this is their livelihood. So they can't take a chance on, if I yell at you, you go run to the corner and cry, and now I'm losing games and I get fired. So they don't really care. And they're going to do the nice stuff on the visit. And then once you get on that campus, they're going to MF you and tell you what's real.
Yes. Yes. And so when do you expose a kid to that, though? Like, or how do you prepare them for that if you're not that? I'm not that kind of coach. I don't cuss that much. I do. I ain't gonna say I scream, but I get intense, right? But I know at the college level, it's just different. When do you expose a kid to that, or how do you prepare them for that if you're not that style of coach?
I mean, that kind of is my style. I'm not just MFing kids left and right, but I will get on a kid, and I'm a fiery coach. I get after it a little bit and play with intense, but this all came from like how I played.
Right.
And I feel like the team usually takes on the identity of the coach. And if you watch us play, you will see that's how I played when I played. So, I mean, you expose it to them early. You're going to get on every single kid there, but there's just certain ways on how to do it with certain kids. But if you want to play at the next level, if you want to play in college or play in pro, you have to learn how to take it. So there ain't no shortcuts. There ain't no ifs, ands, buts about it. You got to figure out how to be successful when somebody is getting on you.
100%. So moving on to when you started club ball, you started with IABP, probably the first national level club team in the IE, going to play everywhere. What was that experience like for you, getting that exposure and just
That's when I found out I really wasn't that good. Because I was good locally. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I wasn't a bad player. But once I got on the national scene and saw the talent from all these other states, and all these other players, and you think of how big, because you think of California is big itself, but then you think on a whole national level, and we started playing teams from New York and Atlanta Celtics and Long Island Panthers, like all these teams. I remember we played Brandon Roy when I was with IABP, and that was, I think that was the first time I seen a pro, like when you knew he was different.
Yeah.
So after that summer of my junior year, I was like, man, I got some work to do. Like, I'm all right, but I ain't there yet. So that was when the light came on for me, where I knew I had to work a lot harder than I was actually working, because I was one of the better players in my area. So you know, you walk around, you think you this, that, and the third, and then you go and play on a national level, and you like, you just a small fish in a big pond. So so that was probably the biggest thing I learned. Like, I'm not anywhere near where I need to be.
What changed then? What was that work ethic? So I'm a player who is good locally, right? No matter what grade, say it's, you know, middle school now, because the world's shrunk with basketball. What work ethic or working hard, how does that look? If I don't know anything and I don't have any resources, I have resources, but I don't know what those resources are. Where do I go to figure out what I need to do to become a Division I player?
Are you saying right now for me
today,
or I'm saying today, when I play?
Today,
I think you have to have a healthy balance. The biggest thing I think with today's kids are, they are more skilled than we were, but they all don't have feel. So there's all these great trainers, and I'm friends with all of them. The Pros Vision, BK over at the tournament, Olin, these are all great dudes who do great things. But some of these kids only train. So they get all these moves in their bag, but then they go play in a game or open gym and don't know how to actually use it when it's real. It's easy when it's a cone right there. Mm-hmm. Like, so I think you have to not only train, but you gotta play. Like, you gotta go to open gyms and just play. That's how you figure out how to use all these moves that you're learning. So it has to be a healthy balance. And I don't think enough kids play nowadays. They all go to these trainers. Mm-hmm. And again, no shade, because some of them are my best friends. They do a phenomenal job. But now you got these kids who have these pre-written mental thoughts in a game, like coming down court, they already have it written in their head. I'm doing a two dribble behind the back, step back, right, fadeaway. And they don't read the defense. The guy could fall down in front of them and they got a dunk or a layup at the rim, but they already wrote in their mind, I'm going two dribble, step back, behind the back, fadeaway.
Yep.
So they don't have feel of the game. So you have to be able to play off, read and react. What is the defense giving you? What are they taking away? So I think a healthy balance of actually playing on top of training. And then obviously you got to get your shots up before practice, after practice, all of those things fall into play. But that's probably the biggest thing. These kids have to, they need to play more. We didn't train. There were
the only guys
that had trainers were NBA guys. So all we could do was play open gym. And that's where we got better. So that's why I said the skill level, this generation is definitely more talented, but they don't have feel.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say it. A lot of them don't have feel.
No, that's the truth. Yeah, yeah. No, we had Adam Harrington on our last show. He's a coach. He's KD's trainer. That's okay. Who he is now. And so what he said was what he saw overseas. He said the development processes, they have their individuals, but then they have short-sighted games where you're playing 2-on-2, 3-on-3, learning that
those
part.
Side of the game,
and then that team play where you're playing all, you know, just hooping. Mm-hmm. 5-on-5, and he said that's the development process in Europe. That's why they develop a lot quicker, because they're getting every piece of that game, and it's what you're speaking to.
Right.
Is, hey, yeah, you got that skill stuff, but playing that part of the game. I like how he broke it down into those three sections rather than two. It's like, yeah, because the short side of the game, now you're learning the IQ side, which is where we have a deficit too, is these kids think, you know, just because I can score over two people, I should shoot it when your corner man's wide open. Like, nah, that ain't it. So. I love that. How do you implement that into what you do in coaching? We're hopping around a little bit, but it's good though. How do you implement that into your coaching now? Like letting the kids just play versus the development side, skill development side, I should say.
So I would say for me, I'm probably the worst trainer because I'd stick to the basics. Because I let these kids go to their trainers and learn all this dribble behind the back stuff. When you train with me, we doing mic and drill, we doing form shooting, we doing playing off 2 feet, all of these things that are really going to help them in college. And again, not that these other moves don't help, but I feel like you got to learn the basics before you get to all this extra stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're going to need it down the line, but you got to learn how to just play regular basketball.
Yeah.
and then expand your game from there. So, I mean, like I said, I'm probably not the funnest guy to train with, but it's effective, and I know it's going to work in a real-life situation because defenses are going to do certain things. You're not going to always be able to get to that certain move, but if you do the basics, I think you'll be all right.
No, I call it daily vitamins. There's just certain things you should be doing in basketball. Everything, the shooting, the layups, the feel, the ball handling, you know, just like ball handling, not moves or all that. And then you add, you know, the dessert, which is all the extra stuff you want to do. You got to get those daily vitamins in or your body ain't going to be healthy or your body of work won't be healthy. So, no, that's, man, that's what basketball should be. That's what it should be. So your junior year, now you've kind of, you know, became who you are, like you're starting to see who you become as a player. What was that, just that year like in high school as a junior?
It was a fun year because, like I said, freshman year, I actually played on freshman, but I think I developed because I didn't go sit on the bench on varsity. Sophomore year, I got in sparingly. I think my coach knew what he was gonna have in the future. So I got in some minutes, same thing with Sean. We didn't play a ton.
And you didn't transfer because you weren't playing?
I did not transfer because I was a six, so world, listen to this. I was a 6'6 sophomore on varsity, tallest kid, and I probably played 6 to 8 minutes a game, maybe. And don't get me wrong, we were really good. We went 27-2 that year. So I wasn't on a bad team not playing. We were good, but.
People leave when they're on a good team not playing.
Yeah. Though. Correct.
And they and their next up is that sophomore year. Sophomores on varsity, I believe, is the hardest year because you're good enough to play, but you're not good enough to make the biggest impact because of the leadership and seniors and experience, right? A lot of kids, especially here in the Valley, man, they leave in that sophomore year because if they just wait, because they've been developed and they've seen it. And in that junior year, you're gonna have a breakout year if you just stay one more year. But they usually leave and then they gotta start all the way over.
That's what happened with me. I'll say this. I always tell that exact kid, because I have one that's gonna be a freshman this year, but it's usually around the sophomore year, like you're saying. This is gonna be the toughest year of your life because all your life, you were probably the best player on every single team you played on. Mm-hmm. This is going to be the first year where there's guys bigger, stronger, faster than you, where you're not getting that playing time that you're used to getting. You're not the man. And it's hard here, mentally. Yep. Like, physically, you're going to get beat up a little bit just because of the physicality and guys are a little bit bigger and stronger. But mentally, you're so used to being the guy and playing and starting and scoring all the points. And now you're the guy that's defense. and you got to sit and watch. Like, it can be tough, but like you said, if you stick out that year and learn, you're going to be ready when it's time to actually step into that role. Actually, I have a kid, Samaje Carter. He was a sophomore for me last year, and he's this same role. He transferred in. I had a Division I point guard, Jermaine Washington Jr., who's now at San Jose State. So he was kind of behind him. And Samaje is going to be really good. He just had a guy that was a little bit better than him in front of him. Could he go on anywhere else and probably play more? Yeah. But he took that year, learned from a Division I guy, got beat up a little bit, and he had a huge summer. Mm-hmm. He got an offer, got his first offer from Cal State Northridge, and he's going to have 2 years to show what he got. You don't need – D1 coaches don't need to see you for 4 years. Now, great, if they see you, hear about you early, that's awesome. But you only need one school to fall in love with you. So if you are patient, you take the time and learn, and it's better to be at a program where maybe you're not playing and you're pretty good. That means there are guys that are in front of you that are better, which means you're going to get better. Iron sharpens iron, and you're going to figure it out because you have to learn how it is or what I have to do to get on the floor. Yeah. So I think that year is crucial for kids, but a lot of them run and they transfer and they don't play. My kid, who'll be my best player this year, Tristan, T, we call him T. He had his sophomore year, we were really good. And he was on the verge of leaving. Mm-hmm. And he stuck it out. And he is gonna have a huge year this year. Yeah. He's probably one of the better local guys that is not getting enough recognition. So.
Yeah, no, that's important. And what I heard in the beginning of what you just said is that you communicated that to your freshmen coming
Absolutely.
In. And I think that's where it gets lost, is when the coach is not 100% transparent that, hey, you might not play. You're good. You're going to be good. You're going to be maybe one of our all-time players. But at first, it's going to be tough.
And I try to tell not coaches, players and parents, like, especially if they're a transfer, when they're coming in. And I had to, you know, I had to talk with Samaje and his dad, who Trayvon was a really good dude. I said, look, Samaje is going to have his time. He's going to be a really good player. But I'm telling you right now, I got a Division I point guard that's already here. So he might not play as much as you might want him to, or as he might want to. But if he sticks it out, like, he's going to have a good career. Yeah. So I think you got to be transparent, like, with these parents and these players. Like, I let them know, if you're not doing enough, you're going to hear from me. Like, I'm going to let you know about it. But I'm very fair. I'm playing the best player. Now, if he came in and he was better than Jermaine and took his spot, then that's what it is.
Right,
I'm playing the best player.
Yes.
But, I mean, obviously, as a coach, you can kind of see certain things in the maturation process of how a kid needs to develop and what the future is going to look like. But I think for me, having played the game at a high level and going through that exact scenario we're talking about, I know what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not just telling you about it. I went through it.
Yeah.
And I think this is why I get the respect I do for my players. Not only, I mean, I'm 6'8", so I look the part, but my players understand that everything that I'm telling them, especially defensively, I actually did it.
Yeah.
So I don't think you have to have played to be a great coach, but it damn sure helps.
Man.
So, I feel like I'm a player's coach. I got great relationships with a lot of my, with all of my players. But, like, I speak from a place of, look, I'm not just saying it. Like, I did
it. So, do you still get out there and hoop with them a little bit?
Oh, man. I played recently, which I don't play a lot. For whatever reason, I got a fear of tearing my Achilles. Because
We almost 40, or yeah, you are 40, right?
I'll be 40 the next month.
Yeah,
a couple weeks. So I don't play a lot, and I played towards the end of the school year last year, and this was probably the worst I ever played in my life. And I was like, man, I am so washed. I'm done. But the funny thing is, I played the year before for the first time at Rancho, so my players hadn't seen me play. And I cooked.
In 1 year, so, huh?
And I was like, okay, I still got it. And that next year came, I was awful. And I just, you know, I have a certain mentality. So I always think I can do certain things. And you get 40, you don't have that same pop. Mentally, I was still smarter than all of them. So I could pass, but I couldn't get by nobody. I couldn't explode. And when you don't play all the time, your touch is not as good around the rim. So yeah. I was terrible. But what I did was I stacked my team. So we still won all the games. Jacob McFarland was home from Houston. My player from my first year, Kimani Davis, who's playing at a D2 in West Virginia, he was there. And then he had brought one of his friends who was a former student. And then I had a Johnny who's on my coaching staff and also a former Division I player. So I knew we were going to win all the games. I just wasn't anywhere as good as I used to be or thought I still was.
Man, you GM'd them. You
hit
the GM and you put the team together. That's what you do.
I knew the outcome was going to be. But
I do coaches against kids every year. So, and I get all my coaches are like young, up-and-coming trainers who just stopped playing. I know exactly what you did.
Right.
I still get my dunk in every year. That's my goal, is to dunk when I'm 50.
Damn, 50?
50, yes. I don't know why.
That's funny, because I got the same goal, but it's for 40, which is coming
you
up.
You 6'8", though.
I don't. Again, as high as you remember me jumping, I do not jump like that. And it, you know, things just hurt when you get old. So it take a lot. And yes. I haven't tried to dunk in a little while, but for my birthday, I'm going to try to get it on film for me. My goal from probably when I was about 32, 33 years old was to still be able to dunk at 40.
Yeah, I don't know why mine's 50. I might be crazy then.
50 is a little crazy.
I'm still doing it now. I mean, I had like a 43-inch vertical.
Yeah.
And so it's still there, like the mechanics. Now, it does not feel the same when I jump. And I know the technique. So, but that's my goal, to stay healthy.
I won't be done.
We can have a whole show about how to stay active in our old age here. But, okay, so going back to your junior year, you guys were good and played at a high level, started getting some attention. Well, you guys were always good, but more Southern California started paying attention a little bit more in your junior year.
I think, like you said, to start the show, I don't get enough respect. I think we do now. I think actually might not be the best thing to say, is, you know, but I think the Inland has the best brand of basketball right now. I think the best players are coming from the IE. LA still, obviously still has great players, but when we were growing up, nobody really knew or cared about the IE. Mm-hmm. So when we ended up beating a lot of teams, I think it was because people underestimated us and we were actually good and we were actually tough as the LA kids, mm-hmm. but nobody really knew us. So it was all LA basketball. So now we started to play kind of on a national level, and you know, we're going to these bigger tournaments, playing these teams from out of state and beating a lot of them. I think my junior year, I think we were 27-4. And then our senior year, we were nationally ranked my senior year. Mm-hmm. But it was a process. We were good in our area my freshman and sophomore year. And then our junior year, where we kind of burst onto the scene, where LA started to kind of take notice. Like, oh, who's Eisenhower? Like, who are these mm-hmm. dudes?
Yeah.
And then senior year, like I said, I think we were ranked as high as 15 or 13 in the country. So, but it wasn't easy, and we had to go like fight for our respect, because the LA guys didn't really respect it because they didn't know, which is normal. But I think we earned the respect of a lot of those guys, and we cool with all the LA guys today. So mm-hmm. you know, it's all love, but we had to work for what we got.
Absolutely. And then senior year, probably you guys' most dominant year, like you said, nationally ranked. You guys had a three-headed monster.
Yeah.
You, Sean, and Corey. I want to talk about, and probably, it's probably a soft spot still, you know, getting to the CAF championship game and what that was like, that experience was like, reaching that level, and just reflecting on it and how you apply that to what happened there to your life now.
So where we come from, especially, you know, me, Sean, and Corey, we're kind of the first to do it where we came from. There was no blueprint. So obviously we got to that game, we were wide-eyed and bushy-tailed. Like, we didn't, you know, we walked into the pond at the time. That's where the Clippers played. We see all these bright lights, this big floor, 20,000-seat arena. We had never been there. And the funny thing is, we beat Long Beach Poly earlier that same season. Mm-hmm. And we played them in the Mission Prep Tournament out in San Luis Obispo, and we ended up beating them. And again, maybe they underestimated us a little bit. And so we ended up beating them. And then I think when they got to that game, obviously Long Beach Poly, historic program, used to being there, mm-hmm. plus having lost to us earlier in the year, they were like, nah, like we're going to be ready. And the thing was, they had 5 D1 players. We had 3. They were a little bit better.
Right.
We maybe snuck up on them, but because we didn't back down. And we didn't back down at the pond, but I just think for it to be the first time in school history, there was a little bit of nerves there. When you look back on it now, there were probably a little bit of nerves there. And, you know, the depth perception, like in high school, it's never seats behind the backboard. Like, there's always a wall. So everything changes. So we lose that game. The next year, they get back to that same game with Sean's senior year. And our coach takes them to Cal State San Bernardino to practice, to prepare for the game. So he was also learning. That was his first CIF championship game. But as you grow and get better, you should pick up on things and learn things. So he did, and they went back, and they were successful, and they won the game. But laying that foundation, it was special to get there. And, you know, we walking around school, and, you know, we the men on campus. And, like, we had a whole, assembly just for basketball, for us making it to that game. Because that was a special – I mean, Eisenhower was old. Like, Eisenhower go way back to the 40s and 50s. So for 60 years, we had never gotten to a CIF championship game.
Man.
So it was a big – that was a special moment. Matter of fact, Ronnie Lott went to Eisenhower, and obviously he's a football player, mm-hmm. Hall of Famer. But he came and spoke to us at our practice before that game.
No, that's dope.
So that was definitely a special moment. And then I took that into my coaching, because when I got to Colony and we got to the CIF championship game, there were certain things that I knew were going to come about, and I just did the best I could to kind of explain. You never – until you get out there in that moment, like, you can't really explain it. You can try to explain it the best you can, but it's a whole different feeling when you actually get out there. But I did the best I could to kind of prepare our players and let them know, like, what's going to happen. The floor, the court is longer, it's bigger, like, you're going to be tired, all of that stuff, and just kind of been on that stage. But, Yeah, it was that was a special experience for us.
Yeah. I think it's always weird that they do have the finals randomly in this big old stadium after playing on a regular floor.
Yeah.
Like, with no, I think maybe the quarterfinals, semifinals, it should lead up to that.
Yeah.
I understand why they don't, because of money, but man, it's crazy to step in there and like you want the two best teams to be at their best ability for that game, and I think that takes away from it sometimes.
It does a little bit, but when you think about it as a kid, that's always the dream and the goal. You want to go play in that arena, and two, you want to win a ring.
Yeah.
And three, it's going to draw a bigger crowd than ever. Like, we almost had the whole bottom bowl filled up. If you see the pictures from that game, especially the two sideline sides, like it was full.
Yeah.
I think we probably had 8,000 to 10,000 at a high school game.
Right.
But both of us were nationally ranked. It was 8 Division I players on the floor, so it was Division I. It was a big deal. So, I mean, I understand what you're saying. Like, if it was played in a high school gym, it could have a little different effect. But as a teenager, that's where you want to get to.
Yeah.
And you do everything you can for all the years you're in high school to get to that game and hopefully win it and win a ring.
So. Absolutely. Absolutely. So what was your recruitment like? So coming out of you're a product of junior college.
Yeah.
What was that recruitment period like? You know, why did you end up at JUCO, and what was your experience like in junior college?
So I would say my first 2 years of high school, I didn't take the classroom serious. I did it just enough to be eligible. And after my sophomore years, when I realized I was actually pretty good, I also realized I needed to get better, but I realized I was pretty good and I could probably play in college, because our head coach would bring a couple guys in that played overseas during the summer, and I was kind of hanging with these dudes. I'm like, hey, you playing overseas? I could play for sure in college. Like, he ain't that much better than me. So, see, I didn't take the first 2 years serious. My junior and senior year, I was on honor roll. It was a little late by then. I was being recruited by Pac-10 at the time. USC was calling, Oregon was calling, but I did not have the grades. So that sent me to junior college. And this is why I'm on my kids today, because I always talk about the importance of getting off to a good start, but just having, you know, good grades throughout. Like I said, our team this past season had a 3.6 overall GPA, and I harp on grades day in and day out, just as much as I harp on basketball. But it was because of the mistakes that I made, and I would be remiss if I didn't. I would be doing them a disservice if I let them make those same mistakes. So this is part of the reason why our administration, they really like the culture that I built there and the brand of basketball that we play, because I take the classroom just as serious. So like I said, didn't do things the right way early on, but didn't really have guidance. Our head coach hadn't coached any Division I players. There was nobody around us that went D1. So we just winging this thing. So when I first started playing, I didn't know you had to have a certain GPA and all this to pass, you got to pass the SAT and all that. So I was just playing basketball.
Yeah.
And by the time I realized I was good, it was a little bit too late. So I had to go to JUCO, did my thing there, finally started taking the classroom serious. But as you know, every D1 don't recruit JUCO kids.
Right.
So you kind of knock off a few of those schools that maybe were recruiting you in high school. So now I'm getting recruited by, you know, Oregon State. Marquette did come in, and all these other schools. I don't know how many offers. I had quite a few offers though, but I ended up settling on San Francisco. But my freshman year at JUCO, I went to junior college in the state of Washington.
Where'd you go?
Pierce College in Tacoma.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I hated it.
From Cali, man, you can't go up there.
That's when I realized, because Oregon State was on me really heavy, and I really considered going there. But I think it was my experience in the state of Washington that I was like, Oregon and Washington kind of similar.
What didn't you like about your experience there?
I mean, again, like you said, coming from Cali, the rain. It rained every day. And it's gloomy and it's depressing and it's sad.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I did the whole college thing. I had some fun. I'm not going to say it was a total disaster, but being a Cali kid, being from the city, like it's a culture shock.
Yeah.
So I didn't really enjoy it. So when I came back and I had all these schools recruit me, I was like, I think I'm gonna stay in California. And but I wanted to get far enough away where I could feel like I'm away for college, but close enough where I could come right back. So San Francisco was perfect down there at WCC, you know, mid-major. But I was like, okay, I think this is my fit. So that's how I ended up settling. But you know, that JUCO session is a grind.
Yeah.
That's probably the hardest level to play at because of all of the distractions, the things you are not being able to be exposed to, the travel, because you know, I got coaches picking you up, and you know, it's a different type of grind. You ain't on campus, you don't have all these facilities and you know, the free meals, and it's a grind. Junior college is a grind. But I think that was another portion of my life that I needed to get where I am now. Like I needed that little bit of a struggle at JUCO to kind of experience some success.
No, I love that, because everybody's journey is different, and it's building you for it's preparing you for what's next, right? I don't think we ever go through anything because we're unfortunate or whatever else. Literally God's building us to get to that next level and preparing you for San Francisco and your coaching journey now, and how to advise kids who you have to tell them to go to junior college in order to get to where they're going to go.
Yeah.
I think it's extremely important that you brought up that your freshman and sophomore year, you weren't great academically. You just got by. And that's what redirected your journey, you know? It redirected your journey, because those first 2 years, because I think a lot of kids think they can just cut it on and like, oh, I could get, no, your freshman, sophomore year really do matter academically.
Everything matters. Like from a young age, now I'm not saying you gotta be training like an NBA pro, which most of these kids are, so you right. kinda do.
Yes, you do.
But everything matters, like your work ethic, your character, your grades, your skill, sometimes your size, like all of it is gonna come into play at some point. So you got to prepare and be ready for that moment when it comes, like you're ready. And for me, and the moment we're talking about was academically, and time the coaches is calling, they look at the transcript, I was like, oh, we can't recruit this kid. Man. This kid, he's not ready. So I get on my kids, especially when they're coming in, like, yo, you got to start now. You can't like trick off this freshman year and still, oh, think I'm going to still be good, because these grades, they matter. So you got to get on it now. So when that time comes and they pick up the phone because you're a good basketball player, and now they're asking about your academics, you're like, oh, okay, he has a 3.5. Okay, we can recruit this kid.
Yeah.
So the higher GPA you have, the more colleges that can look at you. Because certain schools can only recruit a certain type of kid, like the Stanfords and the Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo. Like, you got to be like a 3.8, 3.4.0. To even be considered to go to those schools.
Right.
So the better your grades are, the better chance you give yourself, because you allow for that net to be casted out a little bit wider.
Absolutely. So we're discussing it now, the term student athlete and what that means to you. We were talking about it. We had a Horace on the show a few weeks ago, and he's like, you know, that more than an athlete, you know, he's saying an athlete is good enough in his position because of how he's saying it's like, because an athlete is a student, he is these things. What's your, you know, how do you speak about being a student athlete? More like, I guess if you could put it into two sentences, what would you say a student athlete is?
In two sentences, man, that probably needs more than that. But I mean, I go with the cliche term, which means you're a student first and an athlete second. Because the ball, and I tell all my kids, is the ball is gonna stop bouncing for everybody at some point in time. So it's better to have something to fall back on, because obviously all their dreams are going to the league, but every kid ain't going to the league. So like, what are you gonna do to prepare yourself for life?
Yeah.
So being a good student is gonna help you, it's probably gonna help you out more than actually being a good basketball player, if we're being completely honest.
Yeah, so, yeah. And then student athletes, you brought up a statistic earlier before the show, student athletes and where they end up after the ball starts bouncing. And so just explain that, and you know, how you tell kids, you know, because kids don't want to hear that. They want to hear that they're going to the league, they're going to be a pro, they're going to make money from basketball forever. And some people are lucky enough to stay in the game and make money from, you know, being a trainer or whatever, you know, working for an NBA team, whatever it is. But how important it is for a student athlete to be that student athlete because of where it can lead you after.
I think being a student athlete, like sports prepares you for life. So, and like I was telling you before the show, most people who run Fortune 500 companies, CEOs, they play some type of sports in college. So when it comes to life, you got to be able to communicate. You got to be able to work together as a team. You got to have some type of work ethic. You got to be disciplined. So all of these things, which I learned in basketball, all of that stuff came from basketball, but all of this has helped me in my real life, real world situation. You got to be able to communicate in every facet of your life, whether that's with your teammates, whether that's in your relationship, whether that's with your coworkers, whether that's with you know, your bosses or what have you. But you have to be able to effectively communicate. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, if you have a work ethic, there are certain things that are going to drive you. Because how you do anything is how you do everything. So I'm actually earning my teacher credential now. And as much as I talk about the 3.6 GPA, also my assistant coach, we're both in the same program. We don't just like talk the talk, like we walk the walk. So last year, our program was 2 years. I got a 4.0. I got an A in every single class. But I take pride now in everything that I do. When I was young, I just wanted to play basketball. So I only had pride in that. I didn't take pride in cleaning my room. I didn't take pride in going to school. I didn't take pride in doing my homework. But then I developed a certain work ethic, and now I take pride in everything that I do. So I'm gonna do everything that I can to my best ability. And I learned that from one of my college teammates, the same one I got that quote with the 500. We had one summer, after my first year at USF, we used to work out with this guy named Donovan in San Mateo. So it was like a 45-minute drive, but we used to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, Rome, why are we, it's summer, bro. We don't need to, why are we getting up at 5 o'clock? But it was more than just the workout. It was building this mental part of the game. And like, it kind of turned me into like a monster because to this day, now I get up before work every day. If you see my story, like I'm at the gym, I'm at the gym at 5 a.m. Mm-hmm. So I get up, I work out before work, but like it's become my DNA, it's in my nature, it's who I am now. So even on Saturday and Sunday, I may not wake up at 4:30, but I'm probably up by like 6:30 on the weekends, where I could sleep in at 10 if I wanted to and lounge around and have nothing to do. But like creating that work habit, that work ethic, that discipline, like all of this stuff is gonna spill over into who you are and how you conduct yourself.
Yep. So 100%. I think that waking up piece is so important, and working out. That, like, I only train now if you wake up. I don't train in the afternoon at all because I want kids who I want to change their mindset. I want to change everything they do. And so I'll
tell you how much you really want it.
I had this, he was probably 12, no, he's probably 13, at like 5:30 a.m. and he's just been doing it. And now actually we got it to 7 a.m. because just logistics have changed, but he did it for 2 years straight.
Which is still early.
Yeah, right. 7 a.m. still early, because and he's driving from L.A. to the Valley to do it. And so he's making that sacrifice. And that at first he didn't get it, but then now he loves it.
Yeah.
He
just, and that's how I was. I was mad at Rome all summer. Like, why are we doing this, bro? This is too early. And then I realized, like, oh, okay, this is turning you into a different type of animal, because everybody's not willing to do that.
Exactly.
So if you're doing things that people aren't willing to do, you're going to start to see that level up, and you're starting to create that gap with the ones that ain't willing to do it.
Yep, and it's not physical, it's the mental edge that
it's
you get.
It's more mental than anything.
It's the Mayweather trains while everybody else is sleeping. He starts his workouts 2 a.m. or whatever it is. He's like, you know,
obviously Kobe, mama mentality.
Yep, waking up
3,
super early
in the morning.
Yep, there's something to it. All right, so your journey through junior college, like you said, it was tough. You learned a lot, got the opportunity to play at USF. What was your experience like playing Division I ball, kind of probably reaching a dream of yours, right?
Yeah.
And so
that's what I was going to allude to. It was definitely a dream come true. My very first game at USF was against Stanford, and we played at the Warriors arena.
Nice.
So, which was Oracle at the time, not the new one. And like, I just remember the excitement of going into the NBA locker room and, you know, putting that jersey on for the first time. I had the custom 2K4 Huaraches.
Hey.
So I was ready, and I came off the bench. I think I scored double figures. We ended up losing in overtime. But I remember my JUCO coach Smith called me and just telling me like I had a great game, but it was a dream come true, because that's what you work for from the time you realize, like, you know, you were able to play in college and that's your dream. Which again, for most kids, it's earlier than when I had it, because it wasn't a thing from where I came from. So, but when I got there, like, I was excited, I was hungry, and it was my first college game was probably one of my most special moments, because I feel like you arrived, like, okay, I did it, I'm here. And then I had a good game, so I'm like, okay, I could play here too. Like, I think Josh Childress was on that team. They might have been number one team in the nation that year.
Sheesh.
If not, it was the year before, so they were still really good. They had Hernandez. They had these two twins, not the Lopez twins.
Yeah. After. I know what you're talking about.
They were really good. So I mean, it just kind of lets you know you belong here, and you know this is what you worked for. You earned it, and enjoy it, because it does go quick, especially when you come from JUCO. You only get 2 years. I mean, I did three because I redshirted from an injury, but. Yeah. It goes by like that. You're going to blink and it's over with.
Yeah, you talked about Coach Smith. I think that's important. Yeah. When you went to your second junior college, was at San Bernardino Valley. Yeah, so you came back home, got to play for Coach Smith. What was that experience like, and how do you think that prepared you for that? I don't want to skip over that.
I always say this, because Coach Johnson and Coach Smith are probably the two best coaches that I've ever played for. Coach Johnson in high school taught me how to be a good basketball player, and like what working hard was meant and what it was like. But Coach Smith taught me how to be a pro. Mm. So he took my game to another level. And when I transferred back home, he was like, man, you should have been here both years. And that year before, they had gone to the Final Four, I think, and ended up losing. He was like, if I would have had you, we'd have won it, and blah, blah, blah. But when I got there, he just showed me all of these things, like as far as like development goes, how to 1-2 into my shot, and all of these just little nuances of the game, of like how to beat a defender here, lowering your shoulder, or whether it could be defensively how to slide over, like all of just the little things that take your game to the next level. So I wish I would have played for him for 2 years, but I learned a ton from him in that 1 year. So he's my mentor to this day. He wrote me a letter of rec to get the Rancho Brady job. His son went there. He's from that Riverside area. So I still keep in contact with him today. I went during COVID when we weren't playing, high school wasn't playing. I was driving up to San Luis Obispo, watching their practices, learning like how he does things as a coach. So he was definitely like a father figure to me growing up. So big shout out to Coach Smith.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome. That's awesome. So yeah, back to USF. So when did you have your redshirt? You had your junior year, and then you redshirted the next year after an injury.
Yeah, so obviously you probably remember I was a scrawny kid. I look different now, but I was a scrawny kid in high school. So my first year when I got to campus, my coach told me I was too skinny. So that summer while I was doing the 5 a.m. workouts, I also put on like almost 20 pounds of muscle.
Okay.
So what ended up happening was the doctor told me I gained too much weight too fast, and obviously muscle weighs more than fat. So I developed stress fractures in both feet at the same time. And he said it was because I gained too much weight too quickly. So I had to get these special made orthotics. We start the season, I'm in pain. Both of my feet are hurting. The orthotics are uncomfortable. Third game of the season, the right one ended up, it broke. Mm. So obviously that was early enough to where I could get my ear back. But I'll never forget the play. We were playing Monmouth. They were in a zone, and obviously I was the leaper. We had a lob play. So I was on the right wing. We had the play set up to throw me the alley-oop. I start on the wing. I go to the basket and I plant. And as soon as I planted, I literally heard it pop.
Ooh.
So I heard it pop. My teammate doesn't even throw it. So I go plant. So I run through the baseline. Shot clock winding down. They throw me the ball. I hit a three. So now I scored three points on a broken foot. So now I'm hopping down the court, telling my coach, hey, like, get me, like, I'm hurting.
Dang.
So I don't think he understood exactly what was going on. So
He thought you was getting hyped, like,
we don't call a timeout. So the next possession, we get a stop defensively, we go back down. So I'm still hobbling, I want him to call a timeout, he doesn't call a timeout. They throw me the ball again, I score another basket, mid-range jumper. So now I score 5 points on a broken foot. But after I scored this time, I turned around like, yo, like, you got to get me out of here. So I think we ended up fouling. I go to the training table, and our training name was Brandon, we call him B. I'm like, B, it's broke. B, it broke. Like, I knew it was broken. Mm. So I ended up redshirting that year. But I really went through some adversity after that, because I ended up missing the next 8-9 months with a broken foot. I come back. As soon as I come back, tear my meniscus. After I tore my meniscus, had surgery again, I come back from that. We're at the beginning of the next season, and I tear the ligament in my thumb. So I had 3 surgeries in 11 months. Hey. Our trainer was like, you are the most expensive athlete on this campus right now. So I missed the beginning of my senior year. So obviously I redshirted that year. Now the start of my senior year again, I'm still recovering. So I kind of had a slow start to my senior year because I'm out of shape. Mm-hmm. Don't got touch, feel, timing, anything like that. So it was a difficult time for me. I was kind of went into a dark place, and mental health wasn't really a thing yet.
Right.
It wasn't
That's even a term yet.
So I just kind of had to figure it out. But I was like, God, like, why me? Like, I went through my whole life never missing a game or practice. Dang. Outside of an ankle sprain, which at 15, 14, you bounce right back from those. Like, I had never been injured. And then I'd have 3 surgeries in 11 months. I'm like, what is going on? Like, why? What did I do to, like, deserve this? So I'm kind of, you know, feeling sorry for myself, pouting down, and just kind of struggled a little bit. Thank God I, you know, fought my way out of it. But I think it had something to do from being where I come from, where it's everything's not easy, everything's not handed to me. If I had one of those upbringings where everything was always simple, I'm not sure I would have made it out of there, but I just knew I had to be tough and resilient just because that's what it's like where I'm from. So ended up battling through that, had a decent end of like the second half of my senior year, ended up winning comeback athlete of the year for the whole university, and then most improved for my team. So I ended up winning 2 awards. But it was that was a battle, but I'm big on adversity. Like, I like adversity. I like when my teams go through adversity, because that's when you find out who you are, and that's where you find out what you made of.
What tools did you use during that time to get through that adversity?
Trying to stay around my teammates, because if I would just sit in my room, I would sulk and pout and cry and be frustrated and angry. So just kind of having a distraction, still being in the gym, maybe not being able to play, or being in the weight room, not being able to actually do the lifting. But you know how it is, being on a team, people cracking jokes, you get to laugh, smile a little bit. And they're just trying to, like, focus in on my rehab, trying to get myself back out there. Because obviously taking a year off after having not taken a year off since I was 5 years old was hard. So I had to take my rehab seriously, which I didn't take my first meniscus surgery seriously. And I ended up having another one when I played for the LA Defenders when I was a pro. But like, rehab is very important. So again, all these things that I've learned, I kind of, you know, implement to my kids. Like, I got a couple kids that are out right now, but I'm telling them, hey, go to the trainer, take care of your body. Like take it serious, because if you don't, you're going to re-aggravate it, or you're going to end up compensating somewhere else and hurting something else. So like, all of those things are important. And as tedious as they may be, as painful as they may be, as boring as they may be, like, you have to do them. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself hurt somewhere else.
I have a deeper question to this. Why do you think it is that some people who come from tough places, some of them take this adversity and it propels them to another place, and you use it and you're able to kind of reciprocate it through the kids that you have now, versus someone who takes these moments and they go in the other direction?
I mean, I just think, when it's like where you come from and you trying to like make it out, you got a different type of motivation. And that's not to say a rich kid can't be motivated and work hard and make it. Mm-hmm. But when you come from nothing, like, you know, I was in a single parent home. My dad was around, but I lived with my mom, and like, I was trying to take care of my mom. I was trying to do what I could to like get us out and all those. So you got a different type of motivation. It's not just basketball. Yeah. Like, you got little brothers and sisters back home. You got a mom that's struggling to put food on the table. So it's all of those things. So when you go through that adversity, you literally can't quit, because there's so many people that are counting on you. There are so many things that are like riding on it. So if you don't have the motivation to do it for yourself, like maybe you might do it for mom, or maybe you might do it for your little brothers that, you know, need shoes or whatever the case may be. So you just have that different type of grind when you come from those tough areas.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I wanted you to share that because I think there's a lot of people who are in those situations and they need to see that there's light at the end of the tunnel. Yeah. You know, like there, you just keep fighting, you keep going through and get the support systems around you. That's what I heard from you, is you got a support system, you had your teammates, yeah. You had something to push you through that moment and get you there, plus your why was bigger than you. Mm-hmm. And that's always important, right?
And you're gonna need it. So it's always good to have good people around you, good people in your circle, kind of having a close-knit circle. There's those four or five people, you know, if you pick up the phone, they're gonna answer. You know, if you're going through something, they're going to help you get through it, because you are going to this day, like you are going to go through something in this life. I don't care how perfect your life has been or how perfect you might think it is. You are going to go through something that is going to challenge you, and you're going to need a certain core group of people that you really trust that are going to help you get through that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So we call this little piece the 2-minute drill. Give me the 2-minute drill of your pro journey. So after USF, you graduate, you get your degree?
Got my degree, but yeah. I actually stayed an extra semester to finish. So it wasn't quickly, but I promised my mom I was gonna graduate when I left for college.
There you go.
So I made sure I stayed for, cause I had like 3 or 4 teammates who weren't done either, mm-hmm. and they went. Mm. So I didn't go pro until December of my rookie year, cause I stayed from August to December. Graduated. I didn't even walk because I left early and got on a team, but I finished that degree. I just figured that I was gonna need it. Thank God I did. But you said my journey?
Yep, 2-minute drill. Your pro journey. Where you started and where it ended.
I started in Turkey, which was I played in the Division II team in Turkey. It was a culture shock, different experience. You know, being from the IE to going to Europe and going to Turkey for that matter was a different experience. Like you walking around, people don't speak the language, people don't look like you, you don't really see all these things that you, the brands and stuff you see in the store, everything is different. So it was an adjustment for sure. But I thoroughly enjoyed my pro experience. I think that helped. I was kind of closed-minded, just coming from the IE. I only did certain things. I only ate certain foods. So being able to go play overseas helped me expand. Like there's more out there. Like just give it a try. Just give it a shot. But you know, so first year in Turkey, second year I had my son. So I stayed home, played for the NBA D-League team for the Lakers, but got hurt again that year. So I only played a couple games, tore my meniscus again. But this time I took the rehab serious. Because I knew, like, I didn't do it the first time. So came back after that year, went back to Turkey, and then I went to Ukraine, which is probably the craziest place. I got so many stories about Ukraine, but Ukraine was probably my least favorite of them all, if I'm being honest. Then I went to Japan, probably had my best season. Probably should have stayed in Asia, but I was trying to get back in the Europe market. And then my last year, which was my 6th season, I played in Belgium. And then after that, kind of went through some things, went through a divorce, wanted to be around my son, had my degree to fall back on, was kind of having a few injuries. I probably could have played 2 or 3 more seasons at a high level, but I was going through some stuff, so I came back home and then jumped right into education.
So that's when you started in Colony, or would you?
So I started at, it was a position called a student mentor, which we worked with all the at-risk kids. It was at a middle school. But Colony, it was in Ontario, and Colony was up the street.
Gotcha.
So as soon as I came back, my first team I coached was the middle school team. And this is when I found my passion for coaching. We went undefeated. The team went 1-6 the year before I got there. And then we went 7-0 my first year. I won the championship. So then I was like, oh man, this was all right. And I liked working with kids and seeing them develop and get better and actually implementing all those things I had learned from the coaches I had played for and like seeing them have some, it's a different type of gratification. Like as a player, you got more control over what actually happens on the floor. And it's kind of more, obviously you're in it for your team, but it's a little bit more about self because you get to score the points, you get the rebounds, right. Block shots and what have you. But as a coach, like actually putting a play in and drawing it up and working on it and seeing the kids struggle and then finally get it and maybe you get that backdoor layup and they score, it's a different type of feeling. So people always ask me, do I like playing or coaching more? Obviously, as a player, I'm a player, so I'll always miss playing, but I absolutely love coaching. I found a passion for coaching, so I'm going to be around for it until I can't do it.
Absolutely. I want to go back a little bit. So you said the Ukraine was crazy. Tell me the craziest story from Ukraine.
First of all, again, being from California, always hot. There was snow on the ground from probably November to March. So that was the culture shock there. But, you know, Ukraine is a very poor third world country. Obviously, you know, they're going through that war and stuff now. That was before, well, that was after I was there. But it's just, if you look at the country, it looks like very run down. So when I got to my apartment, I was like, they really got me in the slums. Like, I'm in the hood, and like, it was, you wouldn't want to live there from if I showed you a picture of the outside view. Now, the thing about Ukraine is they don't rebuild a lot of things, but they do renovate. So when I got inside, I was like, okay, this ain't that bad. But when I pulled up, I was like, I'm living here for the next 10 months.
Like, I'm and about they had to get a 10 month season?
Yeah, most seasons are 9 to 10 months, depending on the season. So you're there. We only get to come home 2 to 3 months, depending on where you're at. So you're away for the better part of the year.
And did they pay on time?
Ukraine did.
Okay, good. That's
I actually made the most money in Ukraine, and I probably had the worst experience. So it was just, you know, like I said, it was a poor third world country, didn't look great. I didn't have a great connection with the Ukrainian people either. Like, I got Turkish friends I still talk to today. I got Japanese friends I still talk to today. I just didn't really connect well, like, with my Turkish friends. I mean, my Ukrainian friend or teammates. So it was just, you really by yourself. Luckily, I met my man's Bingo Marix, who, he's from Texas. That's my dog to this day. That's probably the only good thing that came out of Ukraine was that relationship that me and him still have, because the basketball was decent. It was good. Like I said, they actually paid well, but just the living experience, the food, like I was not a huge fan.
Dang. So
it was
what was your favorite place to play?
Turkey.
It was Turkey.
Yeah, I love Turkey. I absolutely love Turkey. Japan and Belgium were cool. And like I said, I had my best season in Japan. But as far as my favorite country to play in, like I love Turkey.
Yeah.
Like I like the culture. I like the people. I like the city.
Did you mess with the food? Was the food okay?
Yeah, but again, at this time, I was still a little bit closed-minded. That was my rookie year. Mm-hmm. I wasn't trying a lot of stuff. Like, I'll never forget, we had a team dinner. They brought our plate out. We had fish. But they brought my fish out. I had the head on it still. Mm-mm. I was like, I am not eating that. I said, can y'all take that back there and chop the head off and bring it back out? I'm not eating this with the head on it, eyes. I don't want my food
to look back at me.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. So... Yeah. That was kind of a crazy like food experience, but Turkish food was pretty good. Turkish delight, their desserts are really good. But the Turkish culture was cool.
That's good. So you said, you know, part of the decision for you to come back and kind of retire was to be with your son more.
Yeah.
Well, how does that weigh on you? Because I know a lot of guys who have families and they're overseas. How does that weigh on you, and how do you make that balance make sense?
It's tough. This is at the time FaceTime wasn't even out yet. We were using Skype. So you had to like be on your computer.
Ladies and gentlemen, Skype is for the kids out there. Yeah, it's just like
right,
FaceTime.
Right, just
and we
like
had to
FaceTime.
Add a dial-up internet connection to get this video. It's very fragmented and very low quality compared to what you have now, but that's Skype.
Honestly, I don't think I could have played overseas before. Like when these dudes were going and was a calling
on the
card,
phone,
like,
yeah.
I'm not sure I could have done that. But so it was, you know, it was tough because you're gone a lot and like you got a family back home at the time, like my wife and son were back home. But I got to see them every day because of the computer, and then they would visit every couple of months. So like I would leave in August or September, usually around August. They would come for Thanksgiving. And then depending on what country you're in, you can either go home for Christmas or they would come back for Christmas. And then they would come back for spring break, and then I would go back home for the summer. So every 2 to 3 months, I was able to like see my kid. Now, just being transparent, my last year in Belgium, I was going through the divorce. Me and my ex-wife had split, and they didn't come visit one time. And my son was 3 or 4 years old at the time. Mm. So I went that whole, and I didn't go home for Christmas that year. That was one of the countries I didn't get to. So I went the whole 10 months. I didn't see my son in person. And that ate away at me. So like I said, starting with the injury and my body starting to break down a little bit, and me not being able to see my son, I just made a decision. I said, if this is gonna be me and her's relationship, I can't go 10 months a year not seeing my boy.
Yeah.
So I made a very tough decision, because obviously basketball was all I knew. So I made a tough decision and decided to hang it up and, you know, just get a job. That way I can be in his life and be around him more so on a regular basis. But that was probably one of the hardest decisions I had to make, was giving up the thing I love most my entire life for the thing I now love most, which is my child.
No.
So.
No, hats off to you for doing it, because I don't know if a lot of people do, and for you not completing that cycle, because you said you grew up in a single parent household, right? And so making sure that you filled that gap, that's the biggest thing we can do, is especially Black fathers, is be in our kids' lives.
I wanted to make sure that I was present in my son's life. And yeah, me and his mom aren't together now, but every other weekend I'm driving, and I hate driving to LA, but I got to drive to LA to go get him. Yeah. He was with me this summer, for the entire summer.
Oh, nice.
We got in the gym, started
lifting. I said he hoops? Weeks.
Yeah, he
He's
does.
16?
He's 16, kind of a late bloomer. Didn't really care to play early. I tried to get him to play, and this bothered me for a little while, because as a basketball player, like, obviously, you want your kid to play. Like, every father who was grew up playing basketball, you want your son to play. Mm-hmm. And he played very early on, then just kind of, like, lost interest in it and didn't really care to play. So it used to bother me. Then I just decided, like, all right, well, I'm going to have that kid that doesn't play. Whatever it is, what it is. Whatever he decides to be, I'm going to support it. And then his freshman year, he finally came to me like, Dad, I want to play. I'm like, man, I wish you would have said this like 5 years ago. Like,
we got to get started.
I could have really made you into a player. But, you know, so he's a late bloomer. He plays at Laces. He made his JV team. He was a sophomore last year. So he likes it now. I don't know if college is in his future, but if it is, great. If it's not, I think after he graduates, he'll probably end up coming to move with me. And I think I want to get him into coaching. I haven't even told him this yet, so he's going to see it on
surprise.
His So if that's something he would like to do, I would love to show him the ropes and get him into coaching early. And maybe, you know, we had this father-son career. That sounds good. We'll see what happens. But, so.
Does he have your height?
He's not as tall as I am. He is tall. He's probably about 6'3", 6'4"-ish.
Oh, he gonna grow.
Yeah, but when I was that age, I was already 6'5", 6'6". I was a couple inches taller. So I don't think he'll get to 6'8". He'll probably fizzle out of maybe 6'5", 6'6". He always tells me, Dad, I'm gonna be taller.
Tell that man to sleep. Drink some water.
His mom is tiny, so, and my mom is tall. So I don't think he got a chance.
gotcha.
Because he sleep a lot.
Hey, man, these kids, you could tell by, you know, how long their limbs are and the muscles filling in and all that, man. I'm pretty good at figuring out how tall kids are going to be in middle school now, because that's where I mainly work, is that middle school space. Like, I'm gonna check, man. He might be a little taller than you think. If he does, you got to hoop. Right. You can't be taller, don't hoop. Yeah. Nobody, you know, yeah.
So you're going to get that question. I get it. All my whole life, I get it. Do you play basketball? How did you play?
You're right.
I did. I'm old now, but I did.
Awesome. So you walked into coaching. You fell in love with it.
Almost instantly.
Yeah, and been rolling with it ever since. That was 10 years ago now?
This is year 11, yep.
Year 11, okay. Yep. So coaching timeline. So you start with middle school. You have an undefeated season. What's next?
So after that, started coaching at Colony, me and Corey, we talked about him earlier. We both coached there for 6 years. But like I said, I started in middle school. I was like, okay, this is kind of fun. And obviously you win a championship, that's always fun. And then our first year at Colony, we had a pretty good year. Then we lost in the quarters and like double overtime at home. to Buena Park. There's certain things, losses you don't ever forget.
Right.
But that next year, our whole team was back. We had all juniors and sophomores that first year. So we were on a mission. And I hadn't won one as a coach, and I actually had won the one I got to as a player, like we lost. But we grinded that whole summer. These dudes were hungry. Probably one of my favorite teams I've ever coached. So we get back to the playoffs, we make a run, we get all the way to the finals, and we actually end up winning. And I'm sitting in the very seat that I sat in 15 years prior where we lost the game. We was on the same bench. I remember like it was yesterday. So my first one as a coach, we ended up winning.
Nice.
And then now some players are starting to come in. They're realizing, like, okay, they got these young, energetic African-American coaches, people are wanting to come and play for us. I was coaching alongside Jerry DeFabris, who's my guy. Shout out to Jerry. He's the assistant commissioner for CIF now.
Oh, wow.
So we won that first one in 2017.
That's why all those games were at Colony. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. He works for me. Yeah, okay. Well, their facilities is
yes.
one thing.
Yes, for sure. For sure. They do have a big.
Because they were, the school is relatively new. But yeah, he works. He was on the board for a while, and then when he quit coaching a couple years ago, he's the assistant commissioner. So that following year, we had lost a lot of those seniors, and then Corey's brother-in-law, Cedric Allman, who ended up playing at Pepperdine, and then I ended up bringing one of my nephews, and then we had a kid that moved back from Virginia, Brent Napper, who's now at Santa Clara.
Oh, yeah.
So they were young that year. So this was Sed's junior year. Denham and BK were freshmen. So we knew we were going to be good again, but they had to kind of go through it. Sed was stepping in to being the man. Denham and BK were learning how to play high-level basketball. So I think we actually got upset in the first round by Upland. We lost at home. That was might have been our only home playoff loss. But that next year, we right back good again.
Because
now Sed's a senior, probably averaged close to 30 in senior year. Now Denham and BK stepping into that sophomore role after playing varsity as a freshman. So we get back to the championship. We win it again in 2019.
Man.
So now you like, man, like.
No, I remember these years. So this is when I was coaching at Heritage Christian at the time. So
we actually ended up getting all the way to the state championship game for the first time in the 100-year history of the school district.
Wow.
And that's the district with Etowanda, Ranch Cucamonga, all of these schools. So
yeah.
100 years, no team had gotten to the state championship, so we were the first ones to do it. We ended up losing, but...
Who did you guys play?
We played Campolindo.
Campolindo, yeah.
Aiden Mahaney, who was a star. And he was a freshman. He kicked our ass. But again, so that year in 2019 was the first year they took the game, the CIF championship game, away from the Honda Center.
Right.
So we actually played it at APU, which was still a bigger venue, but not quite as big. So we got to that state championship game. Now we playing at Sacramento Kings Arena, Golden One, the NBA Arena, and we were kind of shell-shocked. Yeah. Kind of that same experience I went through in high school, which I wasn't shocked because I knew that feeling. I know what it felt like. We played a bad game. And Aiden, like I said, he was a freshman. He went off. He had 20-something. But we just didn't play well. But it was a great experience. And we, like I said, we got there after having never done it before ever in the school's history or the district. So that was a good accomplishment. So I did it. I did a couple more years at Colony. And the plan, because I knew Jerry was on the tail end of his career, plan was always for me to take over at Colony. I was supposed to be the next head coach. Then all of a sudden, COVID hits, and then there was an opening at Rancho Verde. And but matter of fact, Tim Denson was the one who called me.
Really?
Was like, would you be interested? Somebody called him, and he thought of me. And he was like, would you be interested? And at first, I said no, because I was like, nah, I'm in a good spot. I didn't win a few championships here. Mm-hmm. I'm the next in line, so I'm going to take over. And then we actually hung up the phone, and then I thought to myself, I was like, okay, do I want to get my own gig now or wait another 2-3 years before, Jerry decides to hang them up? And I was like, man, Rancho Verde has actually been a really good program.
Right.
So I can go here and win, like now. So I thought about it, and next thing I know, I called back. I said, you know what? Like, yeah, I would like to put my name in the hat. So he made a phone call. Ended up getting the interview set up. Obviously, the rest is history. I ended up getting the job and going into my fourth year there now.
Man, amazing. In that first year, you had some dudes.
Yeah, our first year, we got all the way to the Serie A championship game. Yeah. Ended up losing. I don't really want to get into it, but every time I talk about it, it's a sore
retro spot. Quick one?
Yeah.
So this is 2021.
Yes.
So we played in the semifinal game and lost to Rancho Cucamonga.
Okay.
Heritage Christian did. And I want to know if you had the same experience, because I do want to talk about it. I know it's a soft spot for me too. It's my belief that one of the referees was an alumni of Rancho Cucamonga.
In our game or your game?
Our game. We have a full YouTube video of all the calls that they did not call or the phantom calls they called on us. It was absolutely crazy how this ref just did not let the kids win to play the game.
Yeah.
It was crazy. And I usually don't like to blame anything on the refs, but when they put the video together, it was like, yo, we had Sky Clark as a freshman.
Yeah, I remember.
We had Sky Clark as a freshman. And it was like, that was crazy, crazy experience. But that was our experience.
I'll go into the calls in a second, but first, like, I'll say this. Obviously, we talked about the games moving from Honda Center to, like, this college. So the game was played at Rancho Cucamonga. So yeah. I had to play my CIF championship game on the road, a true road game.
Wow.
For all the marbles. So it should be a neutral site. That's what we're used to. It's been like that for 30, 40, however long CIF been around. But now when we get to the game is absolutely packed, both sides filled to the rafters.
Yeah, that's a big gym too. Yeah,
it's big. We got called for 4 fouls on threes in the fourth quarter alone. I don't think we fouled 4 times the entire season on threes. Hmm. They call a foul, we're up one, 5 seconds, like the game's practically over. My guy goes and contests, they call a foul, kid makes free throws, we're up one, he makes 2 of them, game over. But I was livid.
Yeah.
And to this day, I will always feel like I was cheated out of one.
Yeah.
Because like, again, we talk about the refs and letting the kids decide the game.
Yeah.
They did not let the kids decide that game. To call a foul as like a buzzer beater, no time on the clock, that's how we're going to win or lose the CIF championship game.
Right.
Which we ended up getting the short end of the stick on that one. So that was, that is going to forever be a tough pill to swallow. I will never get over that one.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel the same. I feel like we should have been playing you in the final.
Probably.
No. I remember the film. I was watching film. I remember we were preparing. Yes. Yeah. I remember it. And that was
crazy. Ended up getting a 7 seed, which I knew all along, like what I had.
Yeah.
And I knew we were one of the better teams. And I was like, there's no way we should be a 7.
Yeah.
So we had all these tough games along the way, but I wasn't scared. Obviously, again, coming from where I come from, we don't back down. We don't dodge no smoke. So I was here for all of it. But just the seating we got, I was like, it just wasn't a good look.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's tough. That's tough. So now you've had multiple Division I players develop through your program. You have some up and coming as well. Like you said, you have a DNA to your program of, you know, hard-nosed, tough, skilled as well. And what else? What else are you guys are you continuing to build and be known for?
I mean, everybody knows when they play Rancho Verde, you're gonna have to bring it. You might be better than us, but we are not gonna give it to you. Like, you're gonna have to earn it. Like, I think we are one of the hardest playing teams in Southern California. And to me, that's the best compliment I can get as a coach. I get people come up to me all the time after we play, like, man, coach, your team plays hard.
How do you get that out of your players?
Because that's my only demand. That's the only non-negotiable. Mm. Like, you have to play hard if you play for me. Offensively, again, being a player's coach, I let my kids be who you are. If you're a shooter, be a great shooter. If you're a guy that gets the guy involved, make good passes. If you're a rebounder, go get every rebound. But whatever it is offensively, be that. But defensively, we play a certain brand. You have to do it, and there are no exceptions. And you don't have to do it like everybody else. You You have to do it to the best of your ability. And I do a good job of gauging, because some guys are slow footed. Some guys aren't as tall. Some guys aren't as strong. So whatever your ability is, I do a good job of gauging it. So I can tell when you're not giving me what I know I can get out of you. So you're not giving me that, you're going to sit. And that, obviously they say that bench, that pine is the best teacher.
Man, so ain't it? That's accountability, man. That's accountability.
That is my only demand. Outside of that, have fun, be who you are.
I'm gonna come watch your practice this year.
We get after it.
I got to see that. I haven't seen that. I have. Harvard Westlake, I went to a practice last year.
They get after
very similar.
Rubio does a great job.
Yeah. And I love that environment, right? To be in an environment where the accountability is high. Everybody's playing as hard as they can. I like how you mentioned it again. You said it earlier, just being transparent with a player about where their playing time would be. And now you're saying it, hey, you gauge where they're at. And so you know that one person's 100% effort doesn't look like this person's 100%, but they are both giving 100%. Yeah. And that's what makes it work.
Give me the best that you got, and I'll live with the results. And if you're not ready, you won't play at that time. And then when you are ready, you'll get in. And that is what it is. But we do shell drill every single day in practice. And that's why, again, I'm biased, obviously, but I think we're the best defensive team in the inland, like without question. And the only other guy I think who does it as well as we do is Etiwanda, which Kleckner is on his way out. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, we lost to them in a close one this past year on the road. But if you're going to come play a Rancho, you got to get after it. Yeah. But they know, I let my players rock. So sometimes we'll come down, and we had a game last year where this kid was just cooking. And he came down, he was dribbling the ball, and he looked at the side like, "Coach, what are we running?" I said, "Man, forget the plays.
You
just scored the last eight." So he came down 1-4 flat, got to, because I know what it feels like to be in that zone. I know what it feels like to be cooking somebody. I know that. So as a player's coach, I've been there before. So what I'm going to call a play for when the guy that's guarding you obviously can't guard you, I don't need to bring you off a pick, a down screen to get open. Keep cooking. Right. And then once you miss, then we'll get back to running some sets.
Yeah.
But I may steal a couple plays down, bring you off a double stagger to get you an open look. So there are those nuances in the game where you just got to feel the game out. But I like to let my players play.
Yeah.
And play free. So
Love that. Man. Thank you, man, for sharing your journey, man, and a lot of great moments in that. We're gonna move to our next segment, which is My Rushmore. Let's see. I got a special one for you. I'm not even gonna let you pick yours. I usually let people pick. Yours is top four IE Hoopers of all time.
Top four
IE Hoopers of all time. Could be your generation, could be all time.
I'm gonna go with Corey Benjamin, my big bro, also one of my mentors.
His daughters were in my program out here.
Yeah. I got to put my man Sean Marshall in there. Because, light-skinned dudes, they get a bad rap.
We do.
And Sean is the first tough light-skinned dude I encountered, who didn't back down. He didn't care. So to this day, he ain't changed at all. I would put Corey Benjamin, Sean Marshall. I think you got to throw Lonzo Ball in there.
Yeah.
Obviously, what he did at Chino Hills, that run that they went on undefeated. I actually worked with their mom at the middle school that I was at.
Oh, okay.
So I know the Ball family. And then I'm gonna probably have to put my man DC, Darren Collison.
Yeah.
That's my man too. Known Darren for years. Obviously, had a good NBA career. Played over a decade. And he was one of the better PGs to come out to IE.
For sure.
So
he ended my career. We played him and David Carter when he was on the team. And so when I was at Santiago, our only playoff game my junior year, he gave us I was the defender. Not that game. Both of them gave 20 each. It was bad.
DC can obviously he go.
Yeah.
So that would be my Mount Rushmore.
I like that, man. My four, I'm going Sean, just light skin, and he did his thing. Marvin Lee, Marvin Lee.
I remember Marvin. Marvin was on my
AAU team. Yeah, so Marvin, man.
From the riff, he going back Riverside to the fullest.
Yeah, man. So Marvin.
Lefty, too.
Yeah. He still go. Well, he tore his Achilles, but we just played in an adult league together. His daughter's cold.
Is she?
Oh, man. She plays. So I have her playing with. I have a middle school program, so it's eighth grade. She plays with my eighth grade boys and gives them the business. She be giving y'all buckets. Marvin, Darren, just because he cooked my career. And then I'm about to go Jamal Williams.
Jamal Williams,
man, he was a monster.
You want to talk about a welcome, welcome to the NFL, welcome to the NBA moment? That was my welcome to high school moment. My very first game.
Y'all play Corona Centennial?
Corona Centennial. My sophomore year.
Oh, boy.
And again, I'm not a nervous, scared dude, but obviously I was a little bit nervous my first varsity game, and I knew who he was. I got in probably 5 or so minutes. I think I scored 2 points that game. But he was the real deal.
Yeah.
So he was the first guy I played, and I was like, damn. He's good.
Man, him at Bisma. Oh, man, that from Corona Centennial teams was always good. But, yeah. And there's so many more.
There's so many more.
But those are the four that got at least for my high school years and so forth. But next is Fix the Net. So a misconception about you or basketball that you'd like to make straight. So let us know what it is and how you want to make it straight, and then you can fix the net.
Let me think. Misconception. I mean, I kind of touched on it, but when we go back to the more than the athlete thing, I think as athletes, when we get into the real world, we kind of get put in a box. And obviously, as Division I athletes, high school athletes, I'll be completely honest, we do get catered to, like with the, when it comes to getting the help, especially at the Division I level, and the free ride is not really free because we work for it, but they get paid now. But anyway, like the free ride. Mm-hmm. So there's a misconception, like when those athletes finish and they jump into the real world, like they're kind of lazy. But the one thing I would say is those are probably going to be your hardest workers in the room, because we got a different type of mentality and a type of edge about us. Yeah. And even then, now I'm going into my second year of teaching. I still compete. I want to be teacher of the year. I'm still competitive in that nature. So we have that competitive fire that will probably never leave. And but I don't think we always get a fair shake in the beginning, especially when you just come out, he just got this job because he could coach, or he just got this job because he played basketball. And in fact, a lot of times we're qualified for these positions and we're going to kill it in those positions because we grew up with that athletic background and we are going to push it to the limit.
Absolutely. Love it, man. Fix the net. He can still dunk, ladies and gentlemen. He can still dunk. All right, man, this is where we flip the script. You the interviewer, so 2 questions for me. Could be about anything in the world.
All right, so what motivated you to give back to the kids? I see you doing a lot in the community, a lot with the kids, putting them on certain platforms, training. Mm-hmm. So what's your motivation behind it? Obviously, I know you played and you got that background, but what motivated you?
Not having the information. I was the first athlete of my parents. My older brother is a computer nerd, and so my parents didn't have the information to guide me the right way.
Yeah.
And so I never want anyone to go through what I went through in that way. I love my parents, they're awesome. They supported me, love me.
You don't know what you don't know.
But if there were certain decisions that could have been made that would have put me in it, I only played junior college ball. I never got to play university level ball, but I had a D2 offer as a senior, but it was October of my senior year. I'm supposed to take that.
Yeah.
And my parents didn't know that. My dad, Division I's after you, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. I left junior college mid semester because, the coach really didn't like me. We cool now, but he really didn't. He didn't see my potential.
Yeah.
He didn't see who I was. I was a shell of myself, but then it wasn't that I left the school. I re-enrolled into college, junior college, full time. So my clock kept ticking.
Oh, yeah.
You see? Yeah. And see, like, those are that information. So that's my biggest point. And I love, just in general, I love seeing people develop. Like, I want to take the worst kid, and I'm like, I can make him a college player. That's how I feel. Like, I just love people reaching their goals and seeing them get to the next level. That's literally the story of my life, whether it's, you know, somebody I work with or kids, my family, you know, anybody I'm around, I want to see them get to the
similar
next level.
Quick story, because I think having that knowledge, which is part of the reason, like, I like to get back and coach these kids. I had the kid Jacob McFarland. Mm-hmm. They were in kind of in your shoes. He's kind of the first out of his family, so his parents, they didn't really know the process and how it worked. And I still, I thank them to this day. Like, they trusted me with their kid, and I was on every Zoom call. Like, I almost have full control of his recruiting. Yeah. And when the coaches were calling Jacob, they was like, you got to talk to my high school coach. But I think it's so important to have people around that know the process. Because there are certain questions you have to ask. There's certain things you have to know.
Yeah.
Because if not, you'll get tricked into something, or you won't get something, like a scholarship offer that you probably should have taken. Mm-hmm. Like, if you had somebody in your life like, hey, this might be the best you're going to get, like, you should think about, consider taking this. And you probably would have had you had that information. So, yeah, I definitely, I really respect that. Shout out to the McFarlands.
Yeah, no, I saw you on all his recruitment trips. You were on everything, man. I was like, man, that's dope, because you don't see that anymore where these parents think they know, even though they don't, because they're professionals in their own world. Yeah. Like, nah, it's a different, there's levels to this basketball thing, man. So, no, I saw that when he was on that journey, so.
Yeah, it was a fun experience. I got to really be a part of it, but also show them, you know, the way to go in the ropes, and everything worked out.
Yeah.
So hopefully he has a good freshman year this year at Houston.
Yeah.
Do great. All right, so my next question would be, do you prefer coaching or training? And why?
So,
because obviously you can do both.
Question. Yeah. All right, so I'm gonna say training.
Okay.
But what I've learned is that a trainer is a coach.
Yes, correct.
And if they're doing it right, that's what I learned. So I love.
Yeah, Sean said the same thing. Sean told me the same thing.
Yeah. So if you don't know the game, you can't train. You could teach somebody a skill. You could be a skills developer and not be a like player developer, if that makes sense. Like, there's a bunch of people who could teach you ball handling. But can you teach them how to apply it to the game? Because there's the, what do you want? I won't call it the N1 because I'm old, but ball up or whatever it is, street ball leagues that you go and play in, and you can make money by jumping high and dunking or dribbling crazy, right? Hey, that's a career, but that's not making you a basketball player, like a pro on that level. So I want to get back into coaching. I haven't coached in 5 years since I had my daughter, and I have a son too. So just waiting for them to get a little bit older for me to be gone that long. I want to be around my kids and see them grow. So, Phil Handy is the one who really talked to me about that. He was like, skills training, you got to be a coach. And he's like, that's why even he's elevating himself. He wants to be a head coach now because he's the ultimate skills trainer, right? Skills developer. But it turned him into being a coach. So
yeah, Sean actually told me that same thing. It's just kind of a different aspect, but it is coaching. So I got a kind of a side bonus question.
Yeah.
How do you, because you talked about being able to teach a kid certain things, how do you feel about these kids that go to these trainers and then they look back and their trainer has never accomplished anything, but this guy is telling them this, that, and the third?
It's weird. So, okay. So I played junior college ball, right? Averaged 3 points, maybe. Didn't play at all. I left before my sophomore year. Never played college ball again. What I did, though, I went and acquired information. I worked for Joel Bounassar, Impact Basketball, for 8 years.
I remember, he used to run with the pumps.
I put my grind work in, and then I work for Chris Johnson now. Like, I put myself around people to continue to learn the game.
Yeah.
For the trainers who never accomplished, because I didn't accomplish nothing as a college basketball player, I don't think. I played, I learned, but my training experience came from me actually studying it as a craft, right? For the ones who are out here doing it, I've said it before, man. I think the whole basketball industry needs to be revamped.
Yeah.
Just, I think coaches need a certain certification. If it's the U.S. basketball gold license, I think there needs to be these AAU tournaments. They're money grabs now, so anybody can start a team. I think that us real basketball people who are in this and for the right reason we have to take a step away from the commercialization of it and bring it together to where we know whoever's on that other sideline, like they're ready, or they're, what's the word?
Qualified.
Thank you. They're qualified to coach. They're qualified to develop. And so there's so many certifications and processes out there now. It's like, man, at least get one of them.
Yeah.
At least get one so you can have something. So, no, I clown those dudes. And I tell people straight up, I'm real about this. Right. Like, no, you shouldn't be training with him. And I'll tell you to your face, like, why would he train with you? You haven't taught him anything. Right. Like, so.
That's one of the reasons because I'm not a huge fan of travel ball, just because it's a necessary evil.
Yeah.
But it's a really dirty business if you've been around. There are a lot of idiots running it.
Yeah.
So I literally only coach it because, again, like I said, I'm not a huge fan of it, but I got a bunch of nephews that play, and mm-hmm. I just want them being taught by the right people.
Yes.
Because you go and all these people sell you a dream, and I can get you this, and don't know what they're talking about. Like you said, no qualifications, no certifications, don't really know what they're doing. I watched many other interviews. You could literally, if you got a couple dollars, you could put a team together, and now you're running a team.
Man, I know a dude right now who's just doing it. Like, he literally just has money, and he's running a team for his kids, and it is, and he hires a coach to coach him, but then he wants to coach.
Yeah.
It's like, nah, man, get out of the way. Right. Like, let the professionals be the professionals. I ain't gonna call people out. All right, but yeah, man, that's probably one of my bigger like things. Like, man, how do we make that happen? But it's just so hard because there's so many.
That's why it's watered down now. There's tournaments everywhere. They're charging $30 for parking. Like,
wow.
it's bad.
It's crazy.
We got to do something to fix it. I don't know where you start. I don't know how you do it. But.
So I think we've come up with an idea that once we do it, we'll share it. So I'm working with an organization who they do have an AAU team. Pretty high level AAU team, and we're adjusting how that club system looks. We're going to do more of an academy style, make it more like overseas, and you have to go through this route to be qualified to make that team.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think it's going to take time, and people are going to have to see the benefit, the producing the high level basketball players, right? If you have, this is the rule, you got a pro, nobody can tell you nothing, right? So let's develop the most pros. And I'm not saying NBA, but pros in their mindset and how to approach things, so they're not overtraining, overdoing it, playing 17 games in a weekend. And
well, I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Get
it done. Get it quickly now.
No, I got it. We should be out and rolling this year. And so I can share it with you off camera. I want to make sure it works first before I pitch something like that. But
absolutely.
You know, you're a good basketball mind, couldn't understand it. So I think it'd be good. But man, you have a 24-second shot clock. Let the people know where they can find you and any message that you have.
I'm Coach Jay Dukes on all platforms, TikTok, Twitter, X, or whatever you want to call it, and Instagram. Obviously, I ran to Brady High School, so come check us out. And my favorite quote came from Kevin Durant the year he got drafted. Still know it to this day. Hard work beats talent. When talent fails to work hard.
Yeah, man. Love it, man.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, man. Been great. That's all we have for you today, folks. We'll see you next time. Peace.